Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Professor Michael Sankey in this episode. Michael is the Director of Learning Transformations in the Learning Futures Group at Griffith University, Queensland, Australia. He has a long history of advocacy for online education practice in Australasia, as you'll learn from this episode. It's my great pleasure to be talking with Professor Michael Sankey, who's currently the Director of Learning Transformations in the Learning Futures Group at Griffith University, Australia. Michael is also President of the Australian Council on Open Distance and E-Learning, ACODE, and he has a long history in benchmarking for online learning and promoting leadership and technology-enhanced learning and teaching. Michael, it's really good to be talking with you.
It's a pleasure, Mark. Great to be here.
Brilliant. Can we start with a brief overview of your career and publications?
So it's not that brief. That's the only problem. So, look, I started in higher education in 1990 at the University of Southern Queensland, which is about 120 kilometres west of Brisbane here in Australia. And I started in the media services department as a photographer. And so once I was into a university, I thought, well, I'm in a university, I could probably do a bit more study. So I did my honours year in arts and then did my Master of Education, specialising in open distance learning. Then a bit later on, about 2007, I got my Doctor of Education from QUT, looking at multimodal design and in instructional materials and how we cater for people who have, not learning styles per se, but just the different modalities by which people learn. So after I'd got my master's in 2001, and I was, working in the media services department doing photography and a bit of multimedia and things, I went to my boss, who was the director of the Distance Education Centre at the time. I said, look, I've just got my master's. There was a vacant instructional design role. And I said, how about you give me a run in this role? What have we got to lose? So this was Alan Smith, who some of you might know. Alan was a great guy. He said, okay, well, all right, let's give it a trial. So he put me on as an instructional designer, which at that point was a level B lecturer role. And must have done something right because I ended up with the ongoing role, which was fantastic. It kind of got me out from that, from being professional staff into academic staff, which was one of the things I aimed to do. Then I was also, at the same time, I was also teaching in the Faculty of Education and also in the Faculty of Arts, teaching online units for web design and publishing. And so started to really get my head around the types of technologies we use in teaching and the way in which we design websites and things like that for teaching at the time. So that was back in 2001. Yeah. So very early days of online learning. I think I was using Blackboard 4 or something like that. So I made a reasonably good fist of the instruction design stuff and ended up getting to be a senior lecturer in 2008. Then I kind of, my trajectory changed a little bit. I took on a big curriculum, major curriculum reform project under the then PVC Lynn Hunt, and kind of pushed me in more into that role of leadership and mentoring staff and to actually achieve things associated with their programs. So that was kind of 2008, 2009 time, and then I became the director of the Learning Teaching Support Unit at USQ, which was, that was a great opportunity, and I was that for quite a number of years. But since 2009, I've kind of gone on to do different director roles in different universities. I've been at four universities now. So University of Southern Queensland, I was at RMIT for a short while, then up to Western Sydney University, and now back up to Griffith University in Queensland. So over that time, I suppose I was also starting to get involved in sector-wide stuff. So not just what was happening in our universities. I was a member, I became a member of ACODE, as you mentioned earlier, the Australasian Council on Open Distance and E-Learning. And I was also a member of CADAD, which at the time was the Council of Australian Directors of Academic Development, which has now become CULT to a different group and has embraced New Zealand as well in that. And so over the years, I've been in different executive roles within that group. And I suppose the opportunity ACO gave me was to really look at their benchmarks for e-learning. So at the time they had the ACO benchmarks for e-learning, I pulled together a group of academics and from different universities, and we actually re-looked at those benchmarks that had been in existence for quite a while and reworked them to become the ACODE benchmarks for technology-enhanced learning. So I shifted that focus away from e-learning to technology-enhanced learning, which incorporated the broader elements of using technology to help learning and teaching. That was in 2014, and then we had our first major inter-institutional benchmarking activity where we had 24 universities involved from Australia, New Zealand and the South Pacific. Kind of then started also leading the ACODE Learning Technologies Leadership Institute, which is a biannual activity. And I believe I actually did the institute in 2011, I think it was, when you did it as well, Mark. Yeah. And we and then I was on faculty, and then in 2015 took over from Gordon Sutterby, who you would know, who was running it in 2013. Yes. I suppose time rolls on. I was on the executive at ACODE for a number of years, and now was vice president for the last 4 years prior to this year, and then now am president of ACODE. So that's been a real joy being involved in that. My academic career, I suppose, has seen me do something in the order of 56 peer-reviewed publications so far and counting, and mostly in the areas, I think, of multimodal design, benchmarking of TEL, quality elements of technology-enhanced learning, flipped classrooms, e-portfolios, micro-credentialing, and those type of technology-focused areas in relation to instruction.
Fantastic. That's quite a list.
It's been quite a journey. It's been fantastic, yeah. I've been very blessed along the way, so, yeah.
Excellent. Michael, you mentioned something around, was it 56 peer-reviewed publications and counting? Yeah. Is it possible for you to reach into some of that work and just talk about some of the ideas and themes that your work has provided that you sense are particularly pertinent today?
Yeah, okay. So I suppose more than ever, people are now, obviously through COVID and things like that, we're really reaching into teaching the online space. So this notion, which is I've carried for quite some time, this notion of multimodal design, where we need to provide different representations of content for people to access in different ways. So I'm a big advocate for the use of human voice within online education as a way to personalise content and to personalise interactions that people have with their students, academics have with their students. I'm not talking learning styles as such, but I'm talking about the way in which people consume materials and the way they prefer to consume materials. So clearly, if you go too far, you get into things like cognitive load and things like that, which can be detrimental. So you've got to be sensitive about that. And of course, now with now we have very clear guidelines through the universal design principles and things like that that give us real indication of how we need to provide transcripts of things for people with who might be hearing impaired and things like that. So that kind of all kind of stacks up to be some really interesting stuff that we can do. I mean, a number of the learning management systems can have plugins now to create alternate forms of materials to give an audio of a video and audio of a text file, for example. So there's some fantastic new inventions, as it were, to actually make technology-enhanced learning really far more productive. So we found through our research, my research, that students really enjoyed being able to listen to the human voice. It was particularly helpful for those who didn't have English as a first language. So they could see the material in front of them and hear the human voice speak it through. It actually helped them not only understand the material, but also help them understand the English language, for example, and the language that they were learning in. And so that's been a key theme in my work over the years. I think the other key theme has really been around this notion that higher education quality agencies like TEXA in our case and NZQA are really looking to ensure that now that we're moving to online and that there are private providers coming into the marketplace, that what is being produced for students is quality, so that the online experience is not the same as the face-to-face experience, but it is equivalent to, and that there are checks and balances in place to make sure that those things are appropriately designed and appropriately scaffolded for the students. So we see those coming through in things like the ACODE benchmarks and the standards, particularly like now the new ASCII TELAS standards in terms of the what we can see at a course level and putting a course online. I think we will see them kind of start to gain a lot of interest over the next couple of years. So interested to look at how we will unpack that space as we move forward as well.
Mm. I wonder if we could explore the ACODE benchmarking. You recall we took the concept over to the UK a few years ago.
Yeah, indeed.
And a really, really effective time of universities just sharing their experiences and just getting a sense that they're not alone out there. Quite often they struggle with the same things, they face the same challenges, and it's always useful actually learning how others have dealt with those challenges. Yes, can you talk a bit about some of the benefits of benchmarking and some of the lessons that you've learned along the way?
Yeah, I mean, when we do a benchmarking activity, there are a set of what we call performance indicators across a suite of benchmarks. So in the case of the ACODE benchmarks, there are 8 benchmarks that deal with the notion that their university has policies and procedures in place, that it's part of strategic planning, that there's funding associated with it, that there's sufficient staff support, staff training, student support, student training. And that the pedagogy is considered as well, the online pedagogy and things considered as well. Those are the kind of the benchmark areas. Now, each of those benchmarks have a series of what we call performance indicators. And there are a range of statements associated with performance indicators that one rates themselves against. For example, that there is a technology enhanced learning policy in place. Okay, well, is there, isn't there, or is it kind of housed within other things? If it is there, is it communicated properly? Is it contained within different procedures and things across the university? And so one makes some judgments about those things. And importantly, it's okay to make a judgment, but then you need to back that judgment up with some evidence and a rationale of why you might have given yourself a particular rating. So we use a 5-point scale, and you would rate yourself on that scale and then provide some evidence and some justification as to why that would be the case. Now, you would do that at an individual institution. We're currently running a benchmarking activity at the moment. So there's a whole range of institutions. We're doing it online now because of COVID, of course. It runs every second year. And so every institution, Griffith University, we've looked at, in this particular case, benchmark 2, benchmark 5, 6, 7, and 8. Now, what we do is we will gather maybe 6 or 7 people from across the university representative of the different departments, and each of us will individually kind of rate where we think we stand in these particular performance indicators. We then come together and we share what we found and what we believe is the case, and we come to a consolidated understanding of where we think Griffith is on this particular indicator. That's fine. We can then get the evidence together for that. And from that, we can start to conceive some recommendations of how we might improve our practice. So that's at the individual institution level. Then what we do every second year is we come together and we compare across other institutions. So I gave ourselves a 3 for the fact that a policy is in place, but it's not necessarily linked to everything across the institution. What does Western Sydney University do? What does University of Southern Queensland do? And they might have given themselves a similar rating or better or worse. They get to talk through what that is and why they've given themselves that particular rating. In doing that, we start to understand how other institutions are doing the same types of things. We learn from that and they learn from us. And so it becomes a collegial activity of being able to share good practice and what good practice looks like across institutions. From that activity, then we come back and then look at, okay, have I been too hard on myself? Have we been too hard on ourselves? Or, have we actually been too generous to ourselves? And then we kind of make our final rating based on having compared with other institutions what we found. And that becomes then the catalyst for making change within your institution. And you can put out a series of recommendations that go up to the senior management to say, well, here's what these other institutions found. This is what we're doing. We think we could improve in this area by doing X. And so that's the beauty of benchmarking, is that it's not just about what you do yourselves, but how that's comparing to other institutions and how that stimulates change.
Mm, absolutely. Yeah. My recollection of benchmarking is it's educational from start to finish, because there's nothing more educational than taking a look at your own institution and its own assumptions about how it operates. Absolutely. And trying to find the evidence to back up some of the assertions that you have about how well you're doing, certainly in education.
Absolutely.
So, Michael, we're talking now towards the end of 2020. It's coming up quite quickly. And obviously, it's been a really strange year with COVID-19, lockdowns, a lot of emphasis on emergency remote teaching. What are some observations about online learning and education you'd like to make at this particular moment?
So I think what I'd like to say is, you know, I was started in distance education and as an academic in 2001. Hmm. And, you know, we kind of were fully online, you know, offering fully online courses, but basically we'd taken our traditional distance education packs and basically converted them to PDFs or to web pages and stuck them online. So that would be our modules, our book of readings and our study schedules and those kind of things. We stuck them all online and, you know, we thought we're doing a pretty good job if we got some discussion forums together and things like that. We called that online learning. At the time, it was, you know, cutting edge. We have come so far in that time. It's not the same thing. I mean, we thought that distance learning converted to online was online learning. And we've learned lots of lessons around how that isn't the case. We've actually had to reinvent that wheel quite a bit over recent years. For many years, institutions, there were the distance education institutions like USQ, New England University, Charles Sturt, Massey, you know, Open Polytechnic, who were all kind of, you know, kind of experts in online learning, distance learning and things like that. And then all of a sudden, learning management systems start to get better and institutions start to think, maybe we can do a bit better in the distance, you know, the online education space ourselves.
Yeah.
And so, all of a sudden the traditional distance education institutions are coming under pressure because all these other institutions are starting to put their courses online. And they do it. They didn't have the same baggage that the distance education institutions had because, you know, they had their packages and they'd put their packages online and things like that. So it's been an interesting shift over the last 5, 8 years, 10 years really, I suppose. I mean, Griffith's now been using online learning for 12 years, I think it is. So, you know, we've been using Blackboard here for 12 years and it's been quite a progressive improve in the way in which these tools are used. So the biggest change, though, over the last 5, 6 years has been the big game change has been the notion of using social media and the ways in which students are interacting and preparing, and also this notion of preparing students for the workplace. So where before they did their subjects and they concentrated on the subjects, got their A's or HDs or whatever it is, and then they went out to try and find work.
Yeah.
It's become so important now that institutions are not just doing that, but they're also preparing students for the workplace and to be not just consumers of knowledge, but the co-creators of knowledge and the co-creators of new knowledge. And that's where they can start to become productive from day one of when they walk into the workplace. And so that's become so critical to where we're going with our online distance learning. So they might be able to have the head knowledge, but also being able to translate that through into practice. Now, for distance education, that's a bit different than the face-to-face practice. And so that means there's a lot more emphasis on the way in which we communicate with each other and the way in which we co-create in that online space. Now, fundamental to that is this notion which I picked up on a while ago, which was this thing called pedagogy. I mean, we think in higher education, pedagogy and teaching, but there are so many other different ways in which we conceive learning and teaching. I mean, there's pedagogy and andragogy, heudagogy, and there's paragogy, all these different ogies. And, we've got all these other things called theories of learning, like constructivism, social constructivism, situated learning, connectivism, all these things that we have to kind of make sense of. And so I think particularly in online learning now, this notion of pedagogy, where it's about the peer production of and context setting, students co-constructing and self-directing some of their learning and things like that, has become really fundamental to preparing particularly the online students, for the workplace. What has helped, in our case at Griffith, is this notion that students can be productive, that they're not just empty vessels to be filled, that they're actually working towards their chosen profession from day one of them being in university. And so they are emerging professionals, but as being a professional, they need to be productive by the time they get out the other end. So we start to see the rise of new types of tools within our ecology, our virtual learning environment ecology. We start to see now tools emerging like Office 365 and Slack, and tools that are designed for the workplace. And these are what they call productivity tools, tools that allow people to work together as they were in the, would be in the workplace. And so we start to see the use of these tools within the online and how we merge more, the blended learning space of online and face-to-face learning becoming this merging of activities around these newer types of tools that allow us to do that. To some degree, we've been able to do it in LMSs and things like that, but these newer generation of tools, you know, like Microsoft Teams, for example, really focus that notion of students working together as though they were in the workplace and can be productive towards an end. So I think that's some of the main themes I see kind of emerging, and the way, of course, then we use data to support that things as well.
It sounds like you've just invented authenticology. So using authentic tools to provide students with the opportunity to collaborate in authentic ways.
Yes, yes. And as you link that with things like work integrated learning and service learning and things like that, it becomes even more more authentic.
So how much of that is actually in play at the moment, Michael? I mean, I know it's possible that there are certainly some things we're looking at Open Polytechnic on those lines, but we're in still very early times. Have you seen that in use significantly?
Absolutely. So for example, all our Griffith Online courses, all our business courses now have Microsoft Teams sites associated with them. It's to the point where, you know, where's the LMS going to be in 5-6 years' time? You know, I'm kind of questioning, is that still going to be the way forward? We're not at that point yet, but, you know, we've just built an integration, for example, at Griffith, where we use PeopleSoft as a student management system. And that student management system controls enrollments in courses, and it's always kind of populated the Blackboard sites with their students, as most universities do now. We've now built the integration so it does exactly the same in Teams. And so an academic or a support officer can go in and not only create the Blackboard site, but also create the Teams site with exactly the same enrollments for the academic staff to then to go in and start working within that environment. Now, that's been a real game changer because it saves a whole lot of work for the academics. One of the barriers has been this kind of workload of kind of adding all the students into the team site. So we launched that up a couple of trimesters ago. This trimester we had 360, I think it was, academic staff put their team sites together from day one of their, well, prior to the beginning of the trimester. So, you know, that's just the ones that were done through the automated system with probably another 40 or 50. So it's probably 400 courses, units we call them courses here, who are using Microsoft Teams to work with their students in, you know, in different ways, not all with the view that it's productivity focused, but, you know, to a great extent, that is what's happening. So as they start to use these tools, this is the tools they're going to use when they get out the other end. They're not going to be using a learning management system out in the workplace. I mean, some professional development's done in learning management systems, but not a great deal. They're going to be using these tools like Office and Slack and things like that out in the workplace.
Yeah, fantastic. Michael, what research would you most like to see? If you had a fairly healthy budget to do some research projects, where would you direct it?
Oh, certainly towards that kind of notion of the student being productive, and the co-construction knowledge and more like that. So I'd really like to do a lot more research in that field, you know, as how, if we're going to be doing this and we believe it's the case, it's one thing to say, oh, I think this is the case, but, you know, let's test that along the student learning journey to see that, you know, what we're proposing here is actually coming through out the other end. So as we follow students through their journey, And as we start to see them enter the workplace, are they actually using those tools that we think they're going to be using? And so, you know, we know all the big companies do, but do the smaller businesses start to use that? My wife works for a psychology company. She's a psychologist, but she works for a company that uses Teams. So even psychologists and people like that are using these newer tools. And this particularly, I like this notion of students being productive, not just empty vessels to be filled, but how they feel as though they're actually contributing, not just to their own learning, but also to the learning of others, and the notion of peer-to-peer work and things like that, peer-to-peer assessment, peer-to-peer working, peer-to-peer learning, that kind of thing.
Sounds like a fascinating project that is very much worthy of the investment.
Yeah. So I think that's really the, as we move forward as a university in the learning and teaching space, then that's, we need to be able to say hand on heart, well, what we're doing is, here are the dividends we're seeing for that.
Michael, can we finish with two people you'd recommend as legends of online learning, one whose work or perspective is significantly influencing you now, and one who you think otherwise has an important perspective to share?
The first one, I picked up on that word pedagogy before. Now, the person that alerted me to that notion of pedagogy was a guy called Steve Wheeler, who used to be at Portsmouth University, I think it was. Now, I think he's retired, but he's still an adjunct at Portsmouth University, but he's doing other things now. But he was actually fundamental. He came out to the University of Southern Queensland a number of years ago and was talking about this thing called pedagogy. And I clicked onto it and thought, yeah. And so I followed his work for quite some time and started to pick up on some of these notions of pedagogy and things like that in my own work. So Steve, fantastic guy, and I still use his work quite considerably. The other person, there's a guy called Curtis Bonk, who's from Indiana University. Now, he comes across very strong, very, very strong opinions, but I like it. He kind of taught me to start pushing the boundaries of my own thinking. So here's what I think, and I can actually stand here and say, I think this, here's the reason I think this, and here's some examples of that practice. And he taught me that through some of the podcasts he did and vodcasts he did. He did an online, it was a kind of a video series he did every week. And it kind of enthused me to not be like him, but that, we have a voice and we need to be able to put that voice out there, with the evidence, like benchmarking, put the evidence behind it and the rationale behind it and set it out there and see what people think. And the more I do that, the more I put out my thoughts through Twitter, LinkedIn, things like that, people feed back to me and it kind of teaches me as well. So I'm learning as well as actually putting my thoughts out there. It becomes quite a cathartic thing that I'm not just this expert. I think I'm expert in some things, but I don't think I'm an expert in everything by any means. And so by testing my ideas, I start to hone those ideas and help other people kind of hone those ideas as well, where they put themselves within those particular theories and things. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, Michael, you're a doer, you're a thinker, you're a facilitator. The online learning world owes you quite a bit. Thank you for being a leader and legend of online learning.
Pleasure. Look, thanks so much for talking with me, Mark. It's been great. And all the best over there,
You can learn more about Michael and his work from our website. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com, to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.